Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Hello and welcome. Today I am delighted to be speaking with Jenny Rogers. Jenny is an executive coach and has actually been in the business for over 30 years. She's a trainer and she's also a writer, prolific writer, in fact. And I was just looking through the your book list before we started and kind of noticed a couple in there that I'd read that I hadn't recognized were actually your books. So I was quite excited by that. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you.
So, Jenny, it might be great for us to just start with sort of what is it you're doing now before we sort of look at the history of what you've done, just to get a little bit of a sense of what you're either working on or what your current projects are.
Well, they're much as they have been for the last few years, really. They're a mix, as you said in your intro, of executive coaching, some pro bono coaching for an excellent charity called Smartworks, which aims to get unemployed women back into work, where I'm one of many interview coaches. And also now we're with lockdown, we've also started doing preparation for job search and all that sort of stuff. I am a compulsive writer, so at the moment, tragically, I'm not working on a book, and this feels very dismaying. Just this week, actually, I started very tentatively just writing a few paragraphs, but I'm not sure it'll spring into life as a book. But as well as that, as you said, I also work as one of the faculty for the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, where they do coach training. And I think you had Julia Vaughan Smith to do one of these. And so I also work with Jules, very much as her apprentice, on a series of masterclasses about trauma and coaching, which is very exciting. This is a new field for most coaches, including for me. And I learn so much all the time from that, from her and from others in that field. But I'm not doing that. I'm a mother, a grandmother. I've just taken up a childhood hobby of painting again during lockdown. So that's my life.
That sounds like a very a rich and varied life. And as you spoke there about the Guildhall School of Speech and Drama, I sort of went, oh, I didn't know they did a coaching program. I know they sort of do the arts and stuff. And
yeah.
Curious about what is they do there?
Well, they probably do something very similar to what you do, actually. They got into it not exactly by chance, but through a very good friend and colleague of mine, Jane Cook, who was an associate there. And she introduced the idea of coaching to the faculty there, to the ordinary teaching faculty. And she's a very inspiring teacher. And the whole idea of using coaching in teaching took off, and then a lot of other people, they're associated with the Barbican and with the City of London Corporation, who are their sponsors. People began inquiring, well, we'd be interested in this coaching thing as well. We're probably going back now 8 or 9 years. And so very slowly the idea grew of making coaching a mainstream offering for the school, and offering coach training to anyone and everyone, which is what now happens. Yes. So the course is a very interesting mixture of it could be, for instance, a couple of managers from the City of London Corporation, from the Barbican, and there's always people from the Guildhall School who are professors and other teachers on the staff and performers. It's meant that the courses have had to have a very practical orientation because these are not theoreticians.
They're
practitioners. And so Jane Booth, who leads the whole thing, has somehow twisted the arm of the EMCC to provide a direct route to EMCC accreditation. So it's a great place to work. It really is. It's, we're having to do everything, of course, virtually at the moment, as I'm sure you are.
And as you say that about doing everything virtually and the work that you do with Jules as well, Julia Vaughan Smith, and that sort of trauma and coaching, I'm just curious, what are your thoughts around the sort of the coaching space and trauma right now as we're sort of going through this sort of pandemic space?
Well, that's a very big question. Let's start with the coaching and trauma thing. I think one of the things that's changed in coaching during the time I've been it, and I started it when what I was doing, I didn't even give the name coaching. I'd never heard of the word coaching used to describe what it was I was doing, which was actually coaching. I'd never heard the phrase executive coaching, that was what I was doing. But in those early years, there was a lot of worry about stepping into therapy and of, what if you asked a client something and it provoked a lot of tears and they disclosed something terrible about their childhood, well, what would you do? Let's leave that to the therapists. No, they're nothing to do with coaching. And I remember in those early years, some of the very earliest books on coaching, I remember one, and I was spared the blushes of the person concerned because they've changed their mind now, actually saying that emotion had no place in a coaching session.
Oh, wow.
Well, that does seem really, really bizarre, doesn't it now? But I think it was because as a profession, we weren't really a profession. We were struggling to establish ourselves as something separate. And so there was a lot of emphasis on what coaching was not.
Yeah.
It was not therapy. It was not counseling. It was not training. It was not mentoring. Even though actually it was a little bit of all of those things. And I think now, probably we're a lot more relaxed about it, not least because I think therapists themselves have discovered coaching, and there's a coaching chapter in a lot of therapeutic associations, and there's a lot more crossover. But I think there's still a lot of worry from coaches about the danger of transgressing some of those boundaries. But to go to the sort of second half of your question, the reason I think it's so important and so exciting is that if you take Julia Vaughan Smith's definition, and that she's basing a lot of her work on the work of Franz Rupert, which is a professor of psychology in Munich, who I'm sure she talked about in her podcast with you, on the assumption that what we're talking about here is developmental trauma, meaning times in our childhood, which will mean this happens to almost all of us, when our legitimate needs for touch, for affection, for acceptance were not met. And this could be because our mother had a very difficult pregnancy, that our birth was difficult. Maybe we were separated from our mother because she was ill or we were ill. Maybe our parents were preoccupied with their own difficulties in their own relationship. And so when you begin to define it like that, it really means all of us will have had something like that.
Yeah.
At a time when we were told we were not, in big quotes, enough, we were not good enough, we were not pretty enough, we were the wrong sex, that love was dependent on achievement. We became the vehicle through which our parents' pain was expressed, and so on and so on and so on. And as soon as I began to realize this, I realized actually probably 80% of my clients are bringing something like this to their sessions, but I hadn't really recognized that it was there. And then the question is, what do you do about it? Well, you are not becoming an amateur trauma therapist, that's for sure. But, you know, I won't go on too much about that. But I think if the revelation really to me was something that I had already realized, which was that, and I'm sure all coaches do really, that almost all the difficulties we experience, the barriers that are there between what we'd like to get and what we actually get, are self-generated one way or another. Even though, as clients often will tell you, when I've been a client, I've done this myself, that it's external circumstances that are getting in the way. It's a horrible organization. It's the awful boss. It's because we were born in the wrong class at the wrong time. We're too old, too young. It's all external things. Whereas most of the time it's not. And it's to do with us and attitudes that were formed as defenses in childhood. So I think unless you realize that, the coaching you do will potentially be rather thin and transactional.
And I wonder if it takes an experience or a period of time to really get one's head around that notion that we've all suffered some level of trauma. We all have that experience, and that is in the space. And as coaches, we're not trying to deal with that trauma, but we're recognizing that it's there. But also that idea that it's not the external world. It's our internal world, or our internal reaction to the external that's causing our challenges. For some coaches, I think that's very evident and obvious. But I think for other coaches, there is a period of time of learning, of experience that allows those things to come into place.
Yeah, I completely accept that, and I think you're right. And if you think about it in terms of the kind of learning journey that all of us have to do, I think there's a point where we're naive and we're beginners, where we have to learn basic skills, and we have to learn what the coaching mindset is. We have to learn to keep ourselves out of the way, how to ask the right questions, really what coaching actually is. But all the time, that other stuff will be lurking there. This is the dilemma, really. I think you can expose a beginner coaches to the idea that there is still all of this to learn, while they're learning basic skills and getting confident in those. But I think the whole idea that you can do one short little coaching course and that's it, you're complete and perfect as a coach, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
it's just not true. And I think it explains why so many people start very enthusiastic learning about coaching, and then they find that what they've learned only goes so far. Which isn't to say it's harmful or not useful, but I think the usefulness is going to be a bit limited.
I would say there is a depth to coaching that is almost like a lifelong journey. There's a mastery that one acquires in coaching. And our first learnings of it is our first kind of steps on that journey. And, I've been around coaches that have done a weekend course or a couple of hours online and think they get the full richness of what coaching is. And then when you're working with somebody who's spent some time, whether that's 5 months, 12 months, whatever that might be, learning about coaching and are continuing to develop their practice, you can see that they work at different depths and at different levels. And it's always interesting when you meet people that feel that they can do it in an overnight course, as it were.
Yes, well, I think that's right. I think the moment I stop learning something new will be the time to leave coaching. I'm constantly surprised by what more there is to learn, because what we're talking about here is human psychology, and we are just incredibly clever as a species, and we're clever enough to defeat ourselves a lot of the time. So
I really enjoy that phrase that we're clever enough to defeat ourselves, that idea that we're so smart that we can trick our own selves into
we're absolute experts at self-sabotage. So and that's what we're that's really what we're dealing with a lot of the time, I think, in coaching.
And you know, as I think about this, I think that there is also a beauty to new coaches. I think they approach questioning and exploration from that naive space that allows something else to come in to the space, that sometimes when we've been doing it a while, we get a little caught in our own patterns, which then, you know, we have to go and become new again and relearn something or do a different course, which is why I think coaches kind of shift and move over time between different ways of working, kind of bringing that newness back into the space.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a great privilege to work with beginner coaches, because very often on every course I do at the Guildhall, there's somebody I would think is a natural, never had any training really before, and yet somehow grasps the essence of it. It may be superficially a little bit clumsy, but they seem to have, I would say what they have actually is a curiosity about how that client is seeing the world. And they're able very, very early on, I mean, maybe they've always been able to do it, but it's a great gift if that's true, to suspend judgment.
Yeah.
And that's what makes coaching so special, I think, and I think this is true even when you compare us with certain kinds of therapists. We don't do interpretation.
Yeah.
Not judging, where we can accept. And yet, unlike a lot of counsellors, for instance, we are looking to see something positively change and some action as a result of what has happened in the coaching conversation.
It sort of reminds me a bit of what you were saying about, you know, in those early days where we spoke about what coaching is not and kind of separating coaching from everything else. I remember when I first trained, we talked a lot about you don't go in the past. The past is like a forbidden territory for coaches to go into. You can only look forward. And that was a real defining mark of coaching when I first started. And over time, it's become a lot more, I wouldn't say loose, but a lot more flexible in this idea that we cannot not go to the past. It's part of our client's experience, which we draw upon to help them move forward. It's just this idea that we're not staying in the past and reliving that past, as opposed to ignoring its existence, as it were.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I would consider it mostly wrong for me not to inquire into the client's past. But we're not, I really like the way you put it, we're not dwelling there, but we are looking, what can the past teach us about the attitudes that the client has brought into the present? And what I find is that clients very often have not made those connections. They have never thought that, for instance, that their difficulty, thinking of a real life example here, that their difficulty of delegating has to do with the fact that they grew up in a household where there was a very difficult marriage, and where this client had to, in big quotes, rescue her mother and to try to stop her father drinking. And that the habit of rescuing had become absolutely embedded. And she was unable to let go of the idea that she should be doing her team's work as well as her own. because this would prove that she was being helpful and that they would then love her back, love in inverted commas. She had never made that connection between her experiences as a small girl in a very difficult situation, only child, an alcoholic father, and a very vulnerable mother, having to be, in effect, the parent to her parents. And it was like a blinding light to her, you know. It was like, oh, okay. Not that it's easy. No, I mean, she'd had 20 years to perfect it.
Mm.
More than 20 years, 30 years, actually, to fine-tune that habit of thinking and behaving.
And it sort of, you were saying that, you know, that part of what you do is to inquire into that past. I would imagine or guess or assume maybe that over time that inquiry has become more sophisticated, and that when perhaps new coaches are inquiring, that sort of that lack of sophistication can cause a clumsiness and a stumbling into trauma, as opposed to an inquiry to unearth what might be at play for somebody.
Yeah, well, that's why you still have to be very clear that you're not doing trauma therapy. I think if you discover that what the client needs is a specialist trauma therapist, then of course you suggest it and you coach around how to get that help.
Hmm.
I think that's quite rare. You could, and not to exaggerate the drama of this, I think you can in everyday coaching, the client will have been loved, and there's no doubt that they have been loved, but they still have experienced traumatizing experiences as they've been growing up. So it's, again, it's knowing where your boundaries are. You're always staying within that coaching frame.
Yeah. And as you were saying there about the client being loved, remind me of what you were saying before about where they said that there was no emotion in coaching, with no place for emotion in coaching. And I think sometimes as coaches, because the world of the therapy world has kind of said, you know, don't come into our domain because you don't have the skills to do that, that we get frightened about emotion being in the space because we go, well, we won't know how to deal with it because we haven't done the 5-year therapeutic course. So I also noticed that some, especially new coaches, can have a little bit of anxiety about there being emotion in the space.
Well, we haven't talked. We've been talking about the client. We haven't talked yet about the coach. So it's not that the coach hasn't experienced any developmental trauma, but the client has. You know, it's not, I mean, Jules makes this point repeatedly. There's not them out there who've experienced trauma and us who've never experienced it. Of course it affects us. And when I think about the person who wrote that particular thing I was quoting earlier, my assumption is that they are actually afraid of emotion themselves and not particularly happy about handling it in their own life. And so what that points to us is that as coaches, we have to be very clued up about our own early lives, our own style, our own hot buttons as coaches, and to know when what we could be doing is colluding with a client to ignore the plain fact that there's very deep and strong emotion there that's getting in the way for the client, and then, of course, for the coach as well.
I really like that phrase there. I was just writing it down, colluding to ignore. I often think about collusion as kind of agreeing with something and taking something somewhere with the client without challenging it, agreeing with a client's statement without actually checking is that statement true. But I'd never really delved into that idea of how we might collude by ignoring something and not actually challenging it and agreeing almost secretly to do that ignoring.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think if the client is afraid of emotion and the coach is afraid of emotion, then they're going to, what will happen is that you have a terribly nice, interesting conversation, analyzing everything to death, analyzing the external thing, having a fascinating conversation, for instance, about bullying in the workplace. I wonder how you would define bullying. I don't know. Well, I saw this definition in there's a very interesting article in Harvard Business Review. Have you read that? No, I haven't. Where? What is that? Oh, I can send it to you after that. Yes, well, bullying, of course, is very difficult to define, isn't it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what use is that? You just... the kind of conversation you might have with a colleague. It's not a coaching conversation. Or I think probably something more common is to discuss theories of leadership. So for executive coaches who are doing something they like to call leadership coaching, they might give a little mini lecture about the way ideas about leadership have changed in the last century. Very interesting, yeah. It's not going to help the client really very much.
Because I guess that's where we start to get under the hood of what's going on by getting to that emotional core. You know, how is somebody feeling about something? How is that impacting their system? And when we're just in our thinking and talking and explaining, we're not getting underneath. And whilst I think there is ample space to do the thinking about stuff, there is also that other dimension that we need to, I say need on a podcast about coaching. Someone's going to pick me up on that. But there is definitely a desire or a necessity almost to look at the kind of the full spectrum of that human being that isn't just located in the mind, but is also located in the body when we're doing our coaching work.
That's right. I think it's a fine line sometimes. I do think it's to stay on the topic of leadership, that to ask a client, well, what's your kind of, what operating principles of leadership are you working from? And often people can't answer that. Though you can tease it out by asking some more questions. But that isn't the same as then embarking on a rambling discussion about whether it's Goleman's theories of the six types of leadership style, or, oh yes, that was published in 2002, wasn't it? Yes, what did you think of that? Are you a John Cotter fan, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It doesn't go anywhere, that. It's what matters is what is that client actually struggling with as a leader?
Yeah. And so I know that you've been working as an executive coach for over 30 years, and I'm sort of fascinated about what was that space like when you first ventured into it, and how it's changed over time.
Well, it was very unlike how it is today. For a start, there was no training. So people like me, we had to grab any proxy for training that we could find. And that was where I first heard the phrase executive coach. I went on a course to qualify in the 16PF. I'm sure you know that as psychometric instrument. And everybody was introducing themselves. And the guy next to me said, oh, my name is Ben and I'm an executive coach. I remember looking at him thinking, oh, I think that must be what I do. And he told me that he and his business partner had very fancy offices. This we're talking 1992, probably, in Green Park, and that they were working at very senior levels with all kinds of interesting organizations. And I thought, oh, okay. But he hadn't had any training, nor had his business partner, because there wasn't any. And So I think there was that feeling that, okay, well, we grasped that was what we, sort of what we were doing. There was a feeling we could coach anybody on anything. And there was very little competition. There weren't that many of us doing it. And there were no books, really. I don't know when John Whitmore's book, Coaching for Performance, came out. It was probably, I don't really know. But I certainly hadn't read it. I hadn't read a single book on coaching. And if you compare that with now, when there are tens of thousands of coaches all scrabbling for work, I think what's happened is that the generic all-purpose executive coach has all but disappeared. And what happens instead is that people are identifying themselves by sector, by type of client they coach. So, for instance, I supervise quite a number of people who work in law firms, London law firms. And some of those people are specializing again. They're working with people who want to make partner.
Right.
Or they're specializing in women who have been on maternity leave and are wanting to get back into work. Or people are specializing in types of topic. So career coaching or stress, you know, well-being, that kind of thing. A lot of other professions have adopted coaching colors, haven't they? So
yeah,
debt counselors now call themselves debt coaches very often. People who advise parents are calling themselves parent coaches. So I think the whole coaching market has, as it's grown, it's of necessity, it's segmented itself.
Yeah, because I remember when I first started coaching that we spoke a lot about, you know, you could coach anybody. And whilst I still hold that as a truth, I also recognize that we do specialize, and sometimes that's a choice, and sometimes it kind of emerges from us as a pathway that we take, and we kind of look up one day and go, oh, this is the work that I do, and it's kind of very particular.
Well, I think that's right, but I would say it's the market really decides. And the other thing that's changed is that buyers are much more savvy than they used to be. A lot of them have trained as coaches themselves. If they haven't, they have HR people, for instance, who typically might be the gateway into corporate clients. They've become very skilled in understanding that some coaches work better with some people than others. And now when I first started as a coach, I never ever had to tender for work. Well, I don't do it now. If people want me to tender, I say no thanks. But I think for a lot of coaches, they have to face up to the fact that tendering is the way to get in. Very often onto a coaching list. So all that's changed as well. So I think the market is deciding, actually, what I need here is a coach who can walk that line between therapy and coaching, or what I need is somebody who is really very expert in preparing people for promotion. What I need is a coach who can do this or that thing. I need a female coach. I need a male coach. I need somebody young. I need somebody older. You know, they're much more particular about what they're looking for. Much better informed than they used to be, I think.
Yeah, I think back in the day, you could sort of go, I'm a coach, and an organization go, great, come work with us. Now there are players. Need to go.
No, thank you. We've already got too many coaches. Yes. 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 I mean, I think that's the other thing that's changed as well, that because organizations have realized how valuable coaching is, they've trained up cohorts of internal coaches. So going back to the Guildhall School, they have done that, and with great success, actually. They've got maybe a dozen people on the staff who are fully qualified. and who, along with their day jobs, will do volunteer coaching, sometimes with students, sometimes with other staff.
I would imagine that a coach who's listening to this might go, well, if all of these organizations are training their own coaches, where's my place in the coaching?
Well, I think they're right. They're very right to ask that. But the answer is that the external coach will probably more or less always be used for the most senior people.
Mm.
That where people have an internal cohort, they'll typically be coaching younger, junior or middle level people. And it'll be the more senior people who are considered. This is probably just pure snobbery, actually. It's a badge of office to, my coach, my executive coach works with a real number of other organizations this allegedly wonderful coach works for. So it's become a bit of a status symbol. I mean, that's another thing that's changed, actually. If I think back to the early days, very often people were looking for secret help for a poor performer.
Yeah.
And that, of course, that still happens. But now I think it's much more likely to be seen as, well, you get to a certain level of seniority in this organization. And now, guess what? You can have a coach.
Yeah, I remember when I used to work with somebody who was in the health industry, and they said, if you're performing poorly, you'll get a coach and they'll secretly manage you out. And then one day it turned around. It was like, if you're doing well, you get a coach to help you do better.
Yeah. I mean, there are people, I mean, thinking about how the market is segmented, there are people who do actually specialize in poor performance and will be known to those HR gatekeepers as somebody who might just be the last chance for that person. But this is somebody who fairly and squarely accepts this, I coach people who are in difficulty.
Mm. Yeah, I find it fascinating when I think about, you know, organizations and what takes place in them and around them, and how now you've got all these different layers or types of coaches that work in these different parts of an organization. And it makes me wonder about, do they ever have an opportunity to discuss not the particulars of their work, but perhaps the themes of their work, to understand what's happening systemically within the organization?
Well, yeah, I think they do. I think careful organizations that are big enough to do this, the civil service is an example, where they've been working with coaches for a long time. I mean, I think possibly I was one of the first coaches ever to work in the civil service, going back a long time now, when it was just the Foreign Office. But now it's all, well, a lot of it is in fact all managed, outsourced now. But every now and again, we'll get together to discuss what the common themes are, without betraying confidentiality, of course. And sometimes, again, it probably takes a big organization to do this, we'll have briefings about some major change that's happening in the organization, the things for us to look out for. But I think it's still relatively rare.
Yeah. I would imagine that, especially if you've got a lot of external coaches that you're working with, it can be quite challenging to bring them into a space to explore that.
Most of them will say no, they won't want to do it, or they'll tell you they're too busy, or they assume it's going to be a waste of time. Because sometimes these events are not very well run. I think it is worth doing. If the organization is prepared to invest that time, I think it's down to us really to make the effort to go.
You mentioned psychometric tools earlier, and I'm always kind of aware that when people talk about them, that although I recognize their value, I always have a little bit of that box feeling. And I always have to kind of go, but it's a start point, not an end point when we do this work. I'm curious about your thoughts on psychometric tools and how you might use them within the work that you do.
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask in some ways, Robert, because I've written three books on the Myers-Briggs type indicator, and I've written one on the FIRO-B. So I'm not an objective witness here. I think they're extremely valuable in their place. And I think it's important to know why you're using a psychometric at all and which ones work in what circumstances. So I get a lot of people saying, is it worth qualifying in the Myers-Briggs, for instance? Well, yeah, it might be. It's not a competitive advantage anymore, but it might be a disadvantage not to have it. Mm. But on its own, it's just one instrument. And there's no such thing as a perfect psychometric instrument. I think if you're going to use them, you should probably think about using minimally three.
Right.
And because they all have something different to offer, they're showing you a human personality through a different lens each time. But I think that to answer your question more specifically, they are particularly valuable where people have career issues, where they may help answer the question, who am I really and what do I need? Rather than the panicky question that a lot of career coaching clients ask, which is, who else will have me? I've just been made redundant, or I've just been fired, or I'm so miserable in my job, I want to get out, but where else can I go? So that is really, it's an important question, but it's not the first question.
Yeah.
So that's where I think a clutch of psychometrics, among a lot of other approaches, can be very, very useful in revealing, well, what is it that really makes this person tick? Where are they likely to be happy? Where are they likely to be miserable? What kinds of environment will suit them? What kinds of people will they work with well? Who will they find more tricky? Who will find them more tricky? So I think they do have a very important place, actually. And for people who do team coaching, there are instruments like the MBTI are very, very, very valuable because they don't judge.
Yeah.
There's ways of exploring difference.
And I like what you're saying there really, really a lot about, you know, having a clutch of them. So you're looking at that human personality from these different angles as opposed to a single one. That you go, this is the truth of that person.
Yeah, well, no, it's never is. And I think with the MBTI in particular, it attracts evangelists and who do treat it like a sub-religion. And, you know, it's not. It's got weaknesses. Funnily enough, they're not the weaknesses that the journalists attack it for, but it does have weaknesses. But it has enormous strengths as well. But it has limitations, yeah. They all do, one way or another.
And I think that's sort of, it's also refreshing to hear that, you know, there are these tools and processes that one might use, but they have their flaws to them. So it allows us to go that this is not a perfect system.
Yeah.
I think it's also useful for the coach to know that when they're perhaps talking with clients who want them to use those processes to be able to say, yeah, they're great at this, but this is where the areas where they might not be so great, or this is where they might not be so useful.
Well, that's right. And I think if you can combine them, and it depends what kind of coaching program you're doing. I think I like to work over a longer period of time with clients, perhaps than many coaches do. And I would usually suggest that, as well as psychometrics, I carry out so-called 360 or stakeholder assessments for them, where I interview people they nominate about what it's like working with them. So you're kind of triangulating the information. Mm. Or it's probably more than that, actually. You're working with the data you have about the client's impact on you. You're working with what other people who work with the client at work think about them. And then you also have the apparently objective lens of a psychometric instrument as well. So you're looking at it from several different angles. That can be very, very powerful for a client.
Yeah, yeah, to really witness and reflect upon what's being uncovered as they observe the views of others upon them.
Yes, and I think it's easy to forget as well the amount of courage it may take for a client to agree to do all this. Oh, what might it say about me? What if they all say they hate me? Or what if doing that psychometric shows that I'm peculiar? You know, when these things are just normal, everyday things to us, well, it's easy to forget. It might be quite alarming for somebody who's never done it before.
Yeah, yeah, that's really, really enlightening to hold on to that. You know, if you're doing this sort of work all of the time, you're doing these sort of tests and using these tools yourself, that actually they might be brand new to a client.
Yes, well, it's like working in healthcare, isn't it? That to a doctor or a nurse, it's just every day. It's their workplace. To the patient, it's a terrifying ordeal. And it's not every day. So,
and one of the other things I just wanted to touch on as well was how you balance the amount of writing you do and the teaching that you do and the coaching that you do.
Well, it's quite easy, really, and all of this is part time. So for a long time, I've said I won't do paid work on Mondays and Fridays. You know, in olden times before lockdown, Mondays were devoted to one of my grandchildren, Fridays to admin. So I think it's just about being choosy. Notes. The writing has always been a very, very important thing to me. I think I said when we talked before this that I really am a compulsive writer. One of my earliest memories as a very small child is writing a so-called book, thrusting these ragged pages at my mother and saying, "Sew them together for me, will you please?" So it's some heavily plagiarized story about a mouse, I seem to remember. So it's always been an important part, writing and editing, actually. It's a very important part. So I was editing the school magazine, editing magazines and newspapers at the university, and you know, kept at it ever since, really. So other things have had to fit around that to some extent. But yeah, I think it's just about being choosy about what you do.
And how do you think the writing fits into coaching? So, you know, I know a lot of coaches will do blogs or articles. Some coaches will self-publish. Some are lucky enough to be published. I'm just wondering, you know, do you feel that there is an importance to being able to get what's in your head onto the page?
Well, I love that. I don't know whether it really is a Chinese proverb, but it's a proverb. What we teach is what we most want to learn. And I've always found that that's true. If there's something that interests me, writing is a way for me to find out what it's really about and what I really feel about it and to learn more about it. Because in order to write, you have to investigate, you have to research, you have to get your ideas clear, this is all way before you put anything down on a page or on a screen. So it's to me, writing is another way of learning. But I think for some coaches, they do see writing as quite correctly as a calling card, as respect for the printed page. Somebody else has thought this is worth publishing. Or they may self-publish, which is relatively easy now. So it's something to actually show to people, give to people physically. So it establishes you as having expertise in your field. But I can't really speak for other people here. I can only really talk for myself. It's for me, it's always been twofold, really, a way of conveying to other people what I think is important and that should be shared, and of learning more about a particular topic, getting my own ideas straight on it.
And I know you said earlier that you were doing some scribblings. Is this a new sort of learning for you as well?
Mm. Yes. It's too soon for me to talk about that. But over the years, my writing has become more personal. So I have a book coming, which Sage are publishing in March this year. And I gave it the extremely cheeky title, Coaching What Really Works. Now, I think 20 years ago or more, I would have thought, what a appalling nerve. How impertinent do you think you could say that? Of course, what I mean is what really works for me. And I invite readers to quarrel with me, and I always give my email address. So this has been very, very useful over the years. People have challenged me. They've sent me jokes. They've pointed out typos that I've missed. That's absolutely awful, of course. Given me extra ideas, extra case studies. It's people from all over the world. So that's very enjoyable, but I don't quite know what the reaction to this book will be. It's quite in relatively short, it's 30 quite short chapters of what I think really makes a difference in coaching.
Well, I look forward to reading that and sharing my
quarreling with me on it. This isn't what really works.
Jenny, it's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation with you. If people want to get hold of you or look at your work, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, they can. My website is jennyrogerscoaching.com, and there's a contact me part of that. People want to email me that. I really welcome that. They can get hold of me through the website. Thank you very much, Robert, for asking me and for your friendly and interested questions. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay. All right.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.